Hello and welcome to the Crisis Point Podcast. I'm Eric Sammons, your host and the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. Before I get started, let me just remind everybody to like and subscribe to the channel. I appreciate everybody who's already done that. It helps other people know about it. Also, leave a review on iTunes or whatever it is that people listen to now with their podcasts. It's all different now, Spotify, wherever. Leave a review and hopefully a good one. Okay, so today we're going to talk about Eastern Catholicism. And we have as our guest somebody who probably most of our viewers might already know, which is Carl Olson. He is the editor of Catholic World Report and Ignatius Insight. By the way, everybody, read Catholic World Report. It's a great magazine. Nothing against Ignatius Insight, but Catholic World Report is a go-to source for Catholics, I think. So he is the editor. He's the reason it's humming along. And both are operated by Ignatius Press, also a great organization, has published just awesome works over the years. He is also the author or co-author of several books and hundreds of articles on theology, scripture, apologetics, culture, and current events for a variety of print and online publications. You still have the article, the weekly article with Our Sunday Visitor on scripture?
I did it for 3 cycles. I wrote it for 9 years, and then they kind of wisely passed on. I actually was really surprised when they actually asked me to come back for a second round and then the third round. I was really surprised, but I did that for 9 years. I think it was from 2008 until 2017 or whatever that would be.
Yeah, I remember reading that.
What I do is a Catholic World Report, though. I do post some of the better ones over the weekend for that particular Sunday or for particular feast days. So it, nice. You know, get a new life for those. And people seem to enjoy them.
Very good. He's also a convert from Protestantism, and he currently attends Nativity of the Mother of God Ukrainian Catholic Church in Oregon. And I bring that up because that's obviously our topic. In fact, I think it's a little bit ironic that you've been writing, not really ironic, but that you write these meditations on the scripture readings of the Latin Novus Ordo.
I was wondering when somebody was going to bring this up. It's actually pretty funny. Quick background there. You know, my wife Heather and I entered the Catholic Church in 1997, and it was in a Roman Rite parish, St. Paul's in Eugene, Oregon, which we actually at one time lived right across the street from it. We were in the process of kind of learning more about the Catholic faith, and there was a wonderful, wonderful priest there, Father Tim Akitis. And so we went through the RCIA program, which maybe the most shocking thing is that it was actually a fantastic program. It was all catechism and scripture and for, you know, primary source documents. And then we ended up being on that RCIA team for a couple of years. Great experience, wonderful experience. And then we, through a series of events, actually through my work at that time, I was working in retail advertising. I ended up meeting Father Richard Janowitz, who's the longtime pastor at Nativity of the Mother of God. And we started to go over there just to visit because we became fast friends with him. And then we eventually started going there full time. And actually, I worked for the parish for 2 years. So that's kind of a little bit of the background of how we were introduced to Eastern Catholicism, which, like many Catholics, we really didn't know much at all about it. We were fortunate because Oregon, which is a fairly large state, has all of 3 Eastern Catholic parishes. And the other 2, not surprisingly, are in Portland, right? So, you know, we were just fortunate to basically live 10 minutes away from this parish. And it's been really, I think, an incredible blessing to us and our family.
That's great. Now, what year did you become Catholic?
Went to the church in 1997. I was really ready probably a year or even more before that. My wife, who is much wiser than me, said, I think we should, you know, kind of take our time, really be sure about this. Since she had a lot of questions, we were working through a lot of stuff. So we went through a great RCIA program and then Easter Vigil of 1997. So it'll be 25 years actually this coming spring. Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. Just a few years after me. Now, when you came into the church, I asked this because you ended up obviously eventually Eastern Catholic, but when you first were looking into Catholicism, did you look into Orthodoxy at all as a Protestant?
I did. And I would quickly qualify that by saying I did not do a super deep dive. And this might sound kind of flippant, although in retrospect, it was actually very accurate. when I did look into Orthodoxy a bit and Brett did some reading on it, I think the thing that struck me was the problem with authority, the problem with magisterium. I had not at that point ever gone to an Orthodox liturgy or really experienced directly the worship that you would in an Eastern setting. But just my reading of both history and some theology raised a lot of red flags about authority. And that was a huge issue for me, as it is for many Protestants who become Catholic. And so after doing a little, you know, looking into that a little bit, I just, it was one of those things where we kept coming back to the Catholic Church, and we tried to run away from it a little bit, and then just realized that these other avenues that we'd look into just were not, you know, they were dead ends. And I think in hindsight now, having a lot more experience and knowledge, I think that was the correct, you know, that was the correct view. I have close family, friends who are Eastern Orthodox. We get along great, love each other deeply. But, you know, this is obviously the issue of authority is the one that really separates Eastern Orthodox from the Catholic Church. You know, people will bring up other little issues, and I don't want to discount them, but I think at the end of the day, it is about magisterium and papal authority.
Right, right. Now, let's take one quick step back, just make sure everybody who's listening or watching understands. What do we mean when we say Eastern Catholicism? What is Eastern Catholicism?
Yeah, historically, of course, we look at the date 1054. That's kind of the convenient date that's put on the split between the East and the West. And obviously, it's a very complicated and long drawn historical era and epic. And there's really a series of attempts for the East and West to reconcile in different councils. And it's, you know, incredibly involved. But over time, you had a number of churches, particular churches, Ruthenian, Ukrainian, et cetera, who separated from their communion with Rome, with the papacy, with the Catholic Church. And then over the course of mostly the last five centuries or so, a number of these particular churches have come back into union with Rome. So they are fully Catholic, but they are Eastern, you know, Coptic, Byzantine, Maronite, etc. Although I would say the Maronite, I'll get in trouble if I don't mention this, Maronite is the one Eastern church that never did leave communion with the Catholic Church. And that's kind of a point of pride, you know, probably rightly so. Mm-hmm. But you have 23 particular churches, Eastern churches, as part of different rites of RITES, which are different ways of worshiping, of celebrating liturgy. Obviously, the same essential core, you know, the liturgy of the word, liturgy of the Eucharist, etc. But, you know, as you know, sometimes very dramatically different kind of traditions when we're talking about the music, some of the rubrics, some of the ways that things are, some of the devotions, lack of devotions. I know a lot of my, not a lot, but some of my Roman Catholic friends are sometimes a little bit shocked that, oh, you don't have Stations of the Cross. You don't have the Rosary. You don't, you know, oh, we certainly have those, but those are Western, you know, traditions. You don't see those normally in the East. So historically, it's those kind of Greek-speaking and other non-Latin-speaking churches. And again, most of those were away from communion with the Catholic Church. And then almost two dozen of them have come back into communion with the Catholic Church. And of course, there are Eastern Orthodox Ukrainians, Eastern Orthodox Russians, obviously. But so you have these essentially kind of split churches, right? And so it's kind of like in the East, you have a little bit of a dynamic like you see in the West with Catholicism and Protestantism. Although I would be careful to take that, you know, too far, because obviously there's a lot of theological historical differences between those two splits.
Yeah. And so you said there's 20, is it 23 Eastern?
That's what I've most recently read. I know there's been some dispute. Some people say, you know, 22 or 21 or 23, right, because some of these particular churches are very, very small.
Right.
I'm trying to think of, I can't remember which one, but like there's one that's maybe it's one of the Syrian branches. There's like 50,000.
Right.
In the world, the Ukrainian which we belong to, is the largest in the world. And I think off the top of my head, and I should know this, I think it's about 13 million. Right. I could be off a little bit, but it is the largest. Many of these are significantly smaller, you know, 100,000, 200,000, et cetera. And that really only comprises about 1.5% of all Catholics in the world, you know, so that's part of what a lot of people don't know about Eastern Catholicism, because there's no Eastern Catholics anywhere near them.
Right. And so a phrase just for listeners to know is like particular churches, you know, there is the church, the Catholic Church, which is the universal church that includes everybody who is in communion with Rome. And you have these particular churches, of which most of them are Eastern. I mean, all of them except for one. But yet the one that is the Latin, the Roman, is the one that comprises almost 99% of all Catholics are members of that. And I would imagine most people who are Catholic watching this are members of the Roman particular church. And so there's a lot of details with that, which we're not going to get too geeked up about, although we could. So when it comes to Eastern Orthodox, Eastern Catholicism, why do you think it's necessary to even have Eastern Catholic particular churches? Like, because there's, you know, the idea, like right now, Pope Francis has talked about having one uniform Roman rite. Why not just have one uniform Roman rite for every single Catholic? Why should we have all these different and confusing different particular churches?
Well, I feel like you're trying to sneak in a little opening of the can of worms there.
Well, I'll do that later. I'll make it much less.
No, it's later. It's a great question, especially in the context of the recent motu proprio, which I think is deeply problematic. I think we agree on the real concerns. I mean, I've only been to the Extraordinary Forum of the Latin Rite a couple times in my life, but we, you know, Catholic World Report had a number of articles about this, and I think it's a real, and I think the Eastern Catholic situation can maybe help, or at least shed a different light on it. Maybe have people think about it a little bit different. Because here's one thing you hear, Eric, and you know this very well. People will say, "Well, the thing that's great about, you know, having, say, the extraordinary form of the traditional Latin Mass is you can go anywhere in the world and everybody's doing the same thing." And I always think, "Well, that's not necessarily true." And I think it's I get the sentiment behind it. I kind of agree with the sentiment. But I think it's problematic in that, of course, as Eastern Catholics, it's not the case. If you go to Ukraine, you'll find Roman Rite Catholic churches there. But most of the churches are going to be Ukrainian, either Orthodox or Catholic. And to partially answer your question, why do we need this? My pastor, Father Richard Janowitz, two years ago, he spent about 3 weeks to a month in Ukraine. It's interesting. He had not ever been to Ukraine. He actually himself had been raised a Roman Rite Catholic, and during his college and the seminary years, began doing some research on his family, discovered that on his, I believe it was on his maternal side, that there was a long heritage of Eastern Catholicism, became very interested in it, and he became actually a Ruthenian Rite priest, and then later moved over to the Ukrainian Rite for various reasons. But he went to Ukraine, and it was very striking in talking to him a number of times about his experience there. It was just how organically everything is. Religion there for so many Catholics is tied up, of course, with the way they live, and it's all part of a culture. And if you were just to go in and just rip it out and say, "Hey, we're going to be doing just Roman or, you know, Latin Rite Catholicism," it would be bizarre, to say the least. Not to mention wrong. So these are churches and rites that have developed very organically out of particular cultures. The fact that some of them very small, you know, shouldn't negate the reality of that. I think the beauty of it, part of the beauty of Eastern Catholicism, and John Paul II was really great in talking about this. He really had a strong, placed a strong emphasis throughout his pontificate on the importance of the Eastern Catholic churches, is that it does speak to the authentic diversity within the church. That the church, yeah, we call it the Roman Catholic Church, but really it's the Catholic Church, and the Roman Rite, as you say, is the majority of it, and that's great. Nothing wrong with that. But there is a real authentic diversity here, which speaks to the enculturation, the authentic enculturation, not the facile fake stuff that we see too often, that has developed organically in these different countries around the world. And of course, many of them are in Eastern Europe, in the Middle East, and so forth. We hear about our brothers and sisters in Christ in places like Iraq and so forth, who have suffered defeat, Chaldean Christians, Catholic Christians, etc. And I just think it's important that we appreciate this authentic diversity, that there are, it's all the same. We share in the same worship, but there are different ways of expressing that that reflect one's authentic culture. And I know there's a lot to be said there, I think, about what is authentic culture, because, you know, we live in an age of just completely made up, fabricated junk culture. But these are really rich traditions, and there are really rich streams of thought, of spirituality, of emphasis, that if everything went Roman or Latin, these things would be kind of lost, or at least maybe subsumed. So it's complementary. I mean, I really see this as an important source of complementarity for Catholics who are Roman to appreciate a little bit or learn a little bit more about the Eastern churches.
Right. And also, it's important for everybody to note that the Eastern liturgies are as ancient as the traditional Latin Mass. It's not something like that was created just, you know, 50 years ago or something like that. They literally are from the time of the apostles, just like the traditional Mass. I mean, they developed from the same time frame.
Yeah, the Divine Liturgy of St. John Chrysostom, which is the liturgy celebrated in the Byzantine tradition, which is obviously the largest in terms of people, because you've got the Ukrainian, et cetera. You know, as you say, it has roots that go back to the apostolic era, and St. John Chrysostom was actually involved in how a lot of that liturgy was developed. And of course, over time, it has changed. There have been revisions. I think sometimes people think, well, the Eastern liturgies, it's always been the same right from the very beginning. And that's not, you know, entirely true. There's been these kind of organic changes, just like you've seen, you know, in the West. I'm not a liturgy specialist, but there's a lot of, you know, Father Robert Taft, SJ, ironically, was considered the great expert on these things. And I had the pleasure of meeting him a number of years ago and reading some of his books. And he's a great source for understanding a lot of these different Western, Eastern relationships, especially from a liturgical standpoint. Father Robert Taft's work is very valuable.
Yeah, I've read a number of his works. They are excellent. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the relationship of the Eastern Catholics with, on the one hand, the Orthodox, and on the other hand, with Roman Catholics. So let's first talk about the relation of Eastern Catholics with the Orthodox. My general sense is that, let's just be frank, the Orthodox are not fans of the Eastern Orthodox, the Uniates, or however you pronounce that, as they would call them. Yet there are a number of, I've encountered online and in person, a number of Eastern Catholics who basically call themselves Orthodox in communion with Rome, meaning they're basically Orthodox, but they're in communion with Rome. So I know that relationship's fraught with a lot of issues. How do you see the connection between the two?
Well, I'll admit up front that in one way, I've been kind of happily detached from a lot of that, just because where I live and in our parish, it's not, you know, it's not a upfront issue a lot of the time. Now, having said that, I recall a few years ago, my wife and our three kids were part of a homeschool group, all Catholic. But for a variety of reasons, they were actually doing their homeschool co-op at a local Greek Orthodox church, and which is very kind of them. And excuse me, I got to meet the priest there, a very warm guy, very fun. And we're talking, and he was asking about my background and becoming Catholic and stuff. And then he said, yeah, you know, Carl, he kind of half jokingly said, you know, now that you've come this far, you just need to take that one, you know, final step and enter the Orthodox Church. And I said, well, Father, thank you for the invitation. I said, now, as soon as all the Eastern Orthodox churches can have an ecumenical council, you know, I'd seriously consider what you're, you know, because historically knowing is just not. And I've had that conversation with another Eastern Orthodox priest who I actually got to know quite well. He actually had me come and give talks at his parish. So he is really funny because he was actually a priest of the American Orthodox Church, which some Orthodox consider to be, you know, kind of liberal. Right. the liturgy there was fantastic. He was a great, very Orthodox priest in both senses of the word. You know, but he said to me once, he said, we have you come give a talk. He said, you know, my parish totally gets it. They like having, you know, Catholics come and talk. He said, but don't want my bishop to find out. He would not, you know, not be happy, which what I have found in my experience, and I've actually in the last two or three years have gotten to know a young Orthodox priest who recently became Catholic. And you and I have talked about him a bit, is it's so complicated, and it really comes down almost to the individual person. Now, as a group, I think we can safely say the Russian Orthodox Church is not really a big fan of the Catholic Church, right. You know, and the Greek Orthodox Church. Now, they on a certain ecumenical level at that level of the patriarchs and the Pope, you know, there's a lot of stuff that goes on, and I think a lot of it's fine and so forth. And there's a lot of times these statements that are made, but on an individual level, when it comes down to parish, I mean, it really comes down to the particular person. I mean, I've met Orthodox who are like Catholics are, you know, the spawn of Satan, basically. I mean, they kind of almost have a Protestant fundamentalist approach, a Jack Chick approach. And then I've met a lot of Orthodox and no Orthodox who are just completely the opposite. I mean, they're more Catholic than, a lot of Catholics. So it just, it's hard sometimes to make sense of it, to be honest. It seems to come down to particular dispositions, particular experiences that people have, strange things that happen, and people have a bad experience in this Orthodox church or a bad experience in this Catholic church, and all of a sudden, you know, that's why they denounce it. So really difficult at times to make sense of it.
And of course, Ukraine is the cause of for those who don't know, there's actually a break in communion between the Russian Orthodox Church right now and the Greek Orthodox Church. Yep. Because of Ukraine, because of what's going on there with just the Russian Orthodox are wanting basically some control over there. And of course, Ukrainian yep. Orthodox, I think, is split into two. It's very confusing. I've read articles about it, and I still can't keep up with it. I mean,
I was just going to say the same thing. I've actually read a number of articles about it, and I still really confused. And I think that even people in Ukraine, in a lot of cases, are confused. And then you throw in the political aspect.
Right.
And it becomes just almost a nightmare in a lot of cases.
Yeah. And for those who don't know, the Russian Orthodox Church is by far the largest of all the Orthodox churches. So although technically on paper, the Ecumenical Patriarch, which is Greek Orthodox Church, is kind of the first among equals, whatever. I mean, the truth is that the most powerful patriarch in the Orthodox world is by far the patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church.
Yeah, absolutely true. I think that's absolutely correct. And it's funny because I've known non-Russian Orthodox who are very anti-Russian Orthodox. I mean, it's just, it's strange. So it's kind of like the parallel to me as a former fundamentalist and former evangelical Protestant is how you meet various Protestants. And some of them are, the Catholic Church is, you know, the Whore of Babylon. And then others are like, I'd love the Catholic Church. You know, I'm just not a Catholic because of X, Y, or Z. And so you get, again, a similar kind of dynamic with a lot of Eastern Orthodox.
Right, right. And it really is individual. Like, I know a Russian Orthodox priest here in town, and the Russian Orthodox have the, I think he's Rokor, in fact. And so they kind of have the reputation for being the most kind of anti-Catholic, anti-ecumenical, but this guy, I mean, he's great. And he doesn't, he's happy to chat and things like that. And he's not like attacking the Catholic Church or anything like that. Like crazy. I mean, he obviously doesn't agree with it, but, okay. So that's kind of the relationship with the Orthodox, because here's the thing for people to understand is the Eastern Catholics live in between two worlds. I mean, you have the Eastern side, in the sense that's your whole history, your whole spirituality, your liturgy, everything. But then the Western, in the sense that you're in communion with the Bishop of Rome, who's the head of the Western Church. And so your relationship then with the Roman Catholic Church, we'll call it the Latin, right, whatever we want to call it. Mm-hmm. I think that can be, it seems like I've seen that seems to be a bit problematic, or I mean, not problematic, but a tense at times. In the sense that, I mean, let's just go the Ukrainian. Let's bring a hot button issue. Like the fact that the Ukrainian Catholic Church, aren't there some who want it to be a patriarch who is in charge of it? But like the Rome's not allowing that to happen. But some are saying, no, he just, you know. And so the idea is that Eastern Catholic churches historically, the Eastern churches have always been very independent in the sense that decentralized more. They're not taking marching orders from Rome, and that's their history. And now everything has to be approved through Rome. And I know there's some tension at times with that. Do you see that in practice at all?
Well, from what I know of very little I know of how those things work, I think it's entirely accurate. There are these tensions because the Eastern impulse or tradition or both is against any kind of ultramontanist approach and is more of a, you know, it's funny. We hear constantly of synodality. I don't know if you heard that term. Have you heard that term, synodality?
It's been over my head.
You know, the thing that's beautiful about synodality is just like the word fascism. It can mean whatever you want on whatever day, depending. But more seriously, in the East, there is a authentic and historical tradition of synods in which really we're talking about more local, regionalized approaches to governance and so forth. Now, every form of governance is going to have problems, especially if it involves people. But historically in the East, there's been that sense of, Eastern Catholicism, yes, we absolutely recognize the Pope for who he is. We recognize the Petrine office. Absolutely. But we are the patriarch and the bishops can call the shots on certain things. So the approach, the centralized approach that has really dominated in the church really since, at least the 1800s, late 1800s, Vatican I. I mean, I know there's a lot of arguments about how this all works out. But that, I think we're seeing a swing back now. I think that we went into this really kind of centralized papal centric approach. I think if there's anything positive to be said about Pope Francis' emphasis on synodality, it is on a different approach, maybe to governance. Speaking my personal opinion here, but I'm also a little bit concerned because, again, people are involved and, things could go. But I think that's true. There is a tension. Now, on a more local level, I have a funny story. This goes back to when I was first going to Nativity and a good friend of mine who has now been our parish for 15 years. At that time, he was at the largest Catholic parish here in town, the Roman parish, very traditional, great pastor at that time and still a great pastor now. But the lady no longer who works there, who was the head of, I think she was the head of like Hispanic ministries. And this friend of mine is Hispanic. They got into a discussion once and he mentioned how he would sometimes come over to Nativity for Divine Liturgy. And she said, well, that parish is only 80% Catholic. And so our running joke to this day is we're trying to figure out which 20% we need to figure out. Right. I mean, and it was such a revealing comment because he clarified with her. He said, you realize that it's Catholic, not Orthodox. Right. She said, I know. He goes, well, what do you mean? What is? And she couldn't explain it.
Right.
But there's been historically in America, historically, a very low view of be careful here. Historically, a low view of the Eastern churches. I mean, there really was a Roman heavy approach in America and you had a lot of controversies that went on and it's become much, much better. Certainly much better over the last few decades. I think Vatican II and I think also John Paul II's papacy both helped those things. But historically in America, especially in the 1800s into the 1900s, there was a lot of, just distrust. I mean, what, married priests? Are you crazy? Priests can't be married, et cetera. Those kind of things, right?
Right. It's almost thousands of Eastern Catholics became Orthodox.
Well, and then you have also, I really do think part of the issue too was this certain kind of immigrants were not looked upon well in America, right? And so you've got those issues as well. And it became really a messy time.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, but there are legitimate, I mean, beyond just the spirituality and the liturgy, things like that, it does seem to be to me that there are legitimate differences in like the ecclesiology of the Eastern Catholics and the Latin Catholics. Ecclesiology, the theology of the church, how the church should be run, how it's set up. I mean, there's an acknowledgement that you have to be in communion with Rome. I mean, there's no question about that. But there does seem to be a different view of the papacy and how, at least the idea of how it should be run. Maybe it might be also disagreements about maybe some disputes about how you interpret Vatican I, things like that. But it does seem like there's some real differences of opinion of how like I said, the papacy actually in practice, and Pope John Paul II, he kind of opened that up and said back in the 90s that, yeah, maybe we should have discussions like that. Like, what would you say is like the general Eastern Catholic view of the papacy, the role of the papacy, and what a Catholic's obligation is towards the papacy?
Well, I'm tempted to say that there's kind of a form of papal minimalism in the East. I think that's certainly true in certain parts of the East traditionally. I think there's a long time wariness of a centralized approach. I think maybe some of it reflects a lot of reactions to political situations over the centuries, and the fact that Rome at times has been really heavy handed in how it's dealt with various Eastern churches in relationship with Eastern churches, maybe both Orthodox and Catholic. It's interesting. My interest theologically, what really drew me into the Catholic Church in big part, I mean, I read a lot of Aquinas. I read a lot of Newman. I have St. Thomas as my patron saint, but I really have a deep love for the Ressource Month theologians. We can say, you know, Ratzinger, de Lubach, von Balthasar, et cetera. And I know that, you know, some of them are controversial people, but that, you know, Ignatius Press has been forefront of publishing a lot of them. But my point here is, I find a lot of deep similarities between a lot of the Ressourcement thought and the Eastern Catholic or even Eastern Orthodox thought in a lot of ways. And I think it's because it reflects much more a ecclesiology of communio. It's much more organic. It's kind of difficult to describe, but I think it's what Lumen Gentium was trying to get at. And in my mind, Lumen Gentium is, that's my favorite of all the texts of Vatican II. I think it's a very deeply biblical and patristic text. And I think it tries to capture this communio element of the church, which is much more organic. And of course, it has the sections in there about the papacy and about the hierarchy and the magisterium, but it tries to do it in a much more, again, it's just more holistic or organic as opposed to top to bottom. Right. I think maybe that captures it best. Instead of looking at things like top to bottom, the Pope's up there, he says stuff, we, you know, receive it at the breakfast table, and here, you know, I'm being a little bit flippant, kind of obscure reference to, it's been revisited. Right. But, In the East, there's much more of a, hey, we're all in communion. We recognize the authority of the Pope, but really that authority should be something that's just used in certain cases. I think that there's kind of a principle of subsidiarity here, right, that I think is kind of ignored in the West sometimes. You know, we talk about solidarity all the time, to the point where I don't even know if people know what solidarity is really in terms of Catholic social doctrine, but people don't know much about subsidiarity. Excuse me. And I think that the Eastern ecclesiology reflects a form of subsidiarity. It's like when we need the papacy, when we need clarification, when we need defense on particular issues, and we kind of go up the chain, so to speak, using that hierarchical language, then yes, let's appeal to the Pope. But now, I mean, how many Catholics, you and I know this, how many Catholics are like, well, as you know, me and I go to my parish and then there's the Pope. Right. And like, there's almost no sense of, well, you've got your bishop and you have, you know, And so I think that's one of the big differences. And I don't know if I explained that well, but to me, that's what stands out. And so I think it does at times cause a little bit of attention, without a doubt. I'm sure behind closed doors, there's a lot of back and forth that goes on about this particular right. issue.
Yeah, to use a crude analogy, that's not perfect, but it's somewhat like, you know, I live in Ohio, and do I look to Washington, D.C. for every single yep. decision, or do I look to my town first, then I look to my state, and then maybe the federal government gets involved if it's really needed. But really, it should just stay out of the state unless it's some thing. And I think that seems to be kind of the idea here, is that Rome doesn't need to be running the day-to-day operations of these Eastern Catholic parishes and even most, you know, the Latin Catholic parishes, but instead it should be more localized. And I know when I brought that up myself, I hear a lot of Roman Catholics say, yeah, but now I'm going to have like Cardinal Gregory, you know, or Cardinal, you know, Supich right. or something like that running it. And that's going to be a disaster. But I'm like, well, you could also live where, you know, Bishop Strickland is or something like that. And so it's like you said, there's problems with that arise in both methods.
Yeah, I think that's important. I think that's, I was just going to say, that's key, is that there's going to be particular weaknesses or strengths of both approaches. You know, I sympathize as having someone who's having written about Carlos Supachor before, as Carlos Supachor, when he's at Spokane, and the way that he approached things, and you compare that to his predecessor, Cardinal George, who, by the way, when my wife and I entered the Catholic Church in 1997, he was the Archbishop of Portland for 10 months. That, you know, he was on a stopping between Yakima and in Chicago. And so I have, you know, kind of a deep fondness and love for him. But I get that. At the same time, if you say the same thing about a parish, I mean, you get a priest who has got issues or is doing weird stuff, it's, you know, there's going to be problems. But I think, generally speaking, I think this approach of a more subsidiary communio model is better. But to go back to your analogy, and I don't think it's actually that crude, I think it's a good analogy, this notion of where I live here in Oregon, or you in Ohio and Washington, D.C. It's like, well, it really comes down to, as one of the founders, I forget who it was, Adams or Jefferson, I forget, talk about how it, you know, it comes down to the virtue of the citizens.
Right.
If the citizens aren't virtuous, or to put it in Catholic, if we're not holy as disciples of Christ, you know, why should we go, you know, screaming to Rome if we're not the ones living our lives the way we're supposed to be? So there's going to be constant problems. Where two or three are gathered, there's going to be problems. I think that was, you know, hesitations 2-4, whatever it was. But I just think that, I think that over the last 125 years, give or take, I think that this kind of papal centric model, as important as it was to maybe weather certain storms of the 20th century, and as important as it was for John Paul II in many ways to kind of beef it up as he fought back against, you know, communism and various things, I think we're now at an era where there needs to be a rethinking of how it's approached. I don't have the answers to that. I, if you couldn't tell, I'm a little bit cynical and leery about the whole synodality right now, because even as Cardinal Dolan recently admitted, you know, I'm not sure what synodality is. And I don't know if Pope Francis.
That was a great quote from Cardinal Dolan.
But listen, we got to keep pursuing it so we know what it is. And I'm reminded of Nancy Pelosi's famous, you know, comment about, we don't know what's in the bill, we just have to pass it so we can, you know, find out what's in there. Right. I get a little bit leery of this approach because it's just too hazy. I think we should be a little bit more modest, go back to some fundamentals and some basics.
Right.
I think everything is too grandiose right now. And we're getting a little bit, I mean, I'm getting a little bit far afield, but I think it does apply directly to this. I think there's a grounded quality to the Eastern approach that is missing at times right now in the church. I'll put it that way, where there's not a kind of direct accountability and a face-to-face. I like the fact that Pope Francis talks a lot about the face-to-face. I'm not so sure that the words are matching up to the actions. That's one of my concerns.
Yeah, I get very annoyed with the synodality push, because I've studied enough to know what actual synodality looks like, and this isn't it. I mean, this is just looks like bureaucratic committees to me. Let's just have committees upon committees that then decide. And also, it looks like it's a democratic process. Let's try to vote on doctrine, which has never been what synodality is.
That's the haziness. That's the haziness that really bothers me. At times, when you listen to certain things that Pope Francis says, it's almost like he basically is saying, we just need to, you know, consider everything. It's like, well, what is that? The church doesn't consider everything. I mean, the church has a particular clear mission. It has foundational dogmatic truths it believes, rooted in the reality of the resurrected Christ, etc. This isn't we're just going to kind of reboot and reinstitute things in 2021. Right. I think it's opening doors for a lot of dangerous understandings of what this process is, rather than, I think my big frustration with Pope Francis, and it's directly related to this, is that he doesn't come in with realistic, specific, concrete challenges and say, let's approach this. It's always this big, vague thing. And it's like, hey, let's just go out and shoot arrows into the fog and hope we hit a duck and we can have something to eat tonight. It's a weird approach. I don't.
Yeah.
And you're right. It does not reflect historically, theologically, traditionally, what synods were about and how they've been conducted, especially in the Eastern churches. Does not at all.
I feel like the Eastern approach limits the damage, in the sense that if you get a bad pope, it's a real, real problem. When it's a centralized and everything is running through him. Like, I mean, I repeat this often because I know most Catholics don't know this, that bishops were not all selected by the pope until recently, like the last couple hundred years. And so if you have a bad pope who can select every bishop in the world, you got a real big problem. Whereas if it's, you know, yes, you could say, well, if you have a good and holy pope, then that's a good thing. Yes, that's true. But it's like everything is on this massive level. A bad pope can really do damage that just takes decades to undo. Whereas if it's a little bit more of an Eastern approach where it's like, well, yeah, you could have a bad patriarch and he could do some damage in that church, but it doesn't really touch any of the other particular churches. And so, yeah. And so if you had a situation in America, for example, where bishops are more, oh, my phone's going off in the middle of a podcast, you'd think I would have turned it off.
I thought I was going to beat you to that.
Yeah, exactly. I always try to make sure I turn it off, but I didn't. And so I'm just going to leave that in, though, for people who are watching. The idea, though, is that you don't have this massive damage. If bishops, for example, were selected by the local clergy or by a local, maybe like a metropolitan type area, something like that, yeah, you could have some bad ones. But then the bad ones aren't going to impact the bad bishops picked in Ohio aren't going to impact the ones in Oregon. But here we have a top down. The problem goes everywhere.
And here's another problem we have. And I think it's directly a part of this is that because of the ease of travel and the way things have become, you know, quote unquote global, you can, you know, bishops can start out in Ohio, go to Washington, then to Texas, and then end up in New York City. Historically, you know, there was much more close to home. Again, that aspect of kind of subsidiarity. Now, people say, oh, well, you can't go back to the good old days. Well, my point is there's not accountability when, you know, I think Cardinal Supich is a great example of this. And I've been very critical of him for a number of things over the years. And, you know, in Spokane, before he was taken to Chicago, he was making a complete mess of things there completely. Right. There's no accountability. He was actually the epitome of the airport bishops that Pope Francis would rail against. And yet here he is, he ends up going to Chicago. Well, I know as a fact from a number of sources that's because he spent so much of his time in Spokane, not being in Spokane. He was actually going everywhere doing all these things. Bishops, you know, and I think Father Peter Stravinsky sort of something about this for Catholic World Report recently, he touched on this where he says, hey, bishops should not, once they get set in one diocese, they should stay there. That's it.
Right.
They should not go. Now, that might sound extreme. I kind of wonder if maybe we need kind of an extreme approach because what we have, one of the big problems we have in the church is kind of this clericalism or professionalism, whatever, careerism, and it rewards that sort of thing. And it does speak again to a different ecclesiology. So I think these are things that should be out there. I'm just not sure that these kind of ideas are actually going to be part of the synodality process. I think it's going to be much more just, like you say, kind of bureaucratic kitchen sink approach. And I think I honestly think it's going to kind of fade away and,
Yeah, let's hope so. I mean, yeah, the idea of bishops, I know of bishops personally that, you know, that they were appointed to a smaller diocese and their whole eyes were on getting to an archdiocese somewhere and being appointed there. And it's like, how is that really helping? If they know once you're appointed this diocese, you're there for the rest of your life till you retire, at least your focus is going to be completely different. And, but that's not really the way it works. And actually in the early church, that was the rule that you couldn't transfer a bishop from one to another.
And I think this is, you know, this is interesting because it also kind of reflects on how the practice, and I don't know if this is the practice globally. You probably know this, Eric, you know, with priests serving 5 years, whatever it is, and then they get moved. And this is the kind of a common practice in the United States.
Right.
In most dioceses, in the East, that's not how it usually works. Like my pastor has been at our parish since 1981. He came out and founded it as a mission. We now have, you know, about 200, 250 people. And he's been there, you know, since that time. He had been ordained for about a year. He served there in Cleveland, Ohio area. And then he came out and he's been here ever since. Now people will say, wow, what if you end up with a horrible priest? Okay. Well, that can happen. That kind of goes back to the different issue of, you know, formation and choosing.
Right.
But I tell you, there's something, the dynamic I've seen when you have this kind of situation, and I have to say right up front, you know, my pastor is absolutely phenomenal pastor. I mean, he's good at everything. He's very holy. He's really proven himself over the years just to be a really remarkable priest. So we're very, very fortunate. But there really is this deeply fatherly reality that we see. he's been, we, you know, we know that barring, you know, death or whatever, he's not going anywhere.
Right.
And I think the same thing could be applied to bishops. And I think that what you're talking about is when I first met Father Richard and we started talking and I was a young, fairly young Catholic, I'd say, man, he's so critical of bishops. He seems so harsh on bishops. And I was pretty naive, even more naive than I am now. And and I recently said to him, I said, you know, I remember how I used to think you were so critical. I said, now I think you're not critical enough. And I said, yeah, you've not really changed. I mean, you've been steady. He's had a very steady, and it's, you know, and we have a wonderful bishop and we've had pretty good bishops, but, you know, his issue, and I don't think he minds me saying this, is the careerism. Right. Guys who, like you say, they want, yeah. And I think the way it's set up, it kind of rewards that. And then it speaks to the kind of the approach to ecclesiology. So all those things are kind of interrelated, I think.
Absolutely. One thing I want to kind of end on this note. And I want to ask, what is life like for an Eastern Catholic that is different from a Roman Catholic? Like, for example, it's very, you know, I pray the rosary every day. It's very popular, you know, among Catholics to pray the rosary. You know, I read the Divine Office, which is also a Western, I know there's an office in the East, but yeah, you know, the right. Western one. And all of those devotions, you know, Stations of the Cross during Lent. How is it really, you know, how is your life as a Catholic, your daily life different than for a Roman Catholic?
Well, traditionally in the Eastern churches, you don't have, you know, you don't have quote unquote daily mass. However, in our parish, we have some kind of a prayer or liturgy almost every day of the week when Father's here, which is pretty much all the time. But one thing that's really different is that the approach to devotions, you know, as you know, in the East, you don't have Stations of the Cross. You don't have the rosary. Now, I would say it's really interesting. We go to a Ukrainian Catholic parish, and my running joke is it's a Ukrainian Catholic parish without any Ukrainians. That's not totally true. There's a handful of them, but really we're mostly folks who've come from the Western tradition and have embraced. Now, so our parish is different from maybe a lot of Eastern Catholic parishes, and then it's not really ethnic centered. Mm-hmm. And yet we have a lot of strong ties to Ukraine, and our bishop came out a couple of years ago and spent time with us, and we have Ukrainian dance festivals, and there's a lot of different things that go on that have a lot of direct ties to Ukraine. But it's not, you know, people aren't walking around speaking in Ukrainian, et cetera, et cetera. The majority of our liturgy is in English and so forth. So I would just say that you have a lot of different, of course, prayers and daily prayers, and of course you have the famous Jesus prayer in the East. But you don't have an emphasis on devotions in the same way that you do in the West. Having said that, there's really definitely emphasis on daily prayer, family prayer, having, you know, our priest really encourages everyone to have some kind of an icon corner or a prayer corner where you can spend time in prayer before icons of Christ and Theotokos and so forth. I think those are very, very important things. And then, you know, to me, one of the big differences has always been Holy Week. I mean, Holy Week in the East is so intense. You've got about, what, 8 different liturgies, and you have different prayers. I mean, my running joke is, it's not a joke, I would love to get some of my Protestant friends to come to me to the Friday morning. It's a prayer. I forget what it's called. I should know. Anyway, that basically Friday morning from like 9 to 11:30, it's a 2.5-hour prayer in which all 4 accounts of the Gospels, the Passion accounts, are read in their entirety. So like the first reading is like 6 chapters from John. Wow. You know, and I want to bring some of my Protestant friends and say, hey, you know, I think the Catholics don't read the Bible.
Here you go.
So I, you know, there's a real strong emphasis on, you know, the deification we talked about before we went on, that comes through, something that comes up a lot in prayers, a real strong devotion to Theotokos. Of course, you know, there's obviously that's reflected in the West, strong devotion to the Blessed Mother and so forth. It just shows itself in a little bit different way. So to give a real quick anecdote here as we finish up, I was on a Catholic Answers cruise a number of years ago, and wonderful time, great people. And every night we'd have dinner with a different group of people. And we ended up having a dinner one night with about 15 people. And one of the couples were from a parish where they were very involved in 24-hour Eucharistic adoration, which I think very highly of, and I think is phenomenal, and really, you know, would certainly be part of that if I was in a Western parish. And they asked, well, we were talking about Eastern Western stuff, and they obviously didn't know much about Eastern Catholicism. And they said, well, you know, do you have Eucharistic adoration in your parish? And I said, no, you don't have Eucharistic adoration in Eastern churches. And I might as well have just said, you know, the Pope is the Antichrist. I mean, they were shocked. They were shocked. And we started having this conversation. I was trying to explain, you know, historically, you know, Eucharistic adoration really came about as kind of a pushback against Protestant heresies coming out of the 15th century, 16th century, rather, denying, you know, the real presence, et cetera, and it developed in different ways. You know, like my pastor likes to say, it's like, we've had all kinds of Christological heresies in the East, but we've never had a Eucharistic heresy. You know, it's just with kind of a smile. And that thing is, you know, that's kind of a little bit shocking to people. But then somebody who was there, who was a Western Catholic, but had been to a number of Divine Liturgy, said something I thought was really interesting. They said, you know, if you were to attend a Divine Liturgy in the East, you would kind of understand why you don't need to have Eucharistic adoration. And I thought that was kind of a remarkable little comment. Mm-hmm. I didn't take it. It wasn't triumphalistic. Right. It wasn't antagonistic. It was more like when you see the reverence that is given in the East and the way that the Eucharist is approached and the way that it's, you know, liturgy is done, you know,
right.
You know that you are going forward to receive the body and blood, soul and divinity of Jesus Christ. That isn't to say that we're more holy, not at all. It's just there's such a strong liturgical emphasis on these realities that I think in kind of the average mass, in my experience, the average mass at a Roman parish subjectively just doesn't exist. It doesn't exist to the degree that I think it should. It sometimes gets lost. I really have sometimes a hard time going to just a what I would call, quote unquote, kind of a typical mass, as snobbish or as bad as that sounds. I just, after years of going to Divine Liturgy.
Yeah, it's like a culture shock, I'm sure. in fact, I tell people that my path to eventually becoming a member of a traditional Latin mass parish was through the East, because I was going to the typical kind of suburban Novus Ordo parish. Didn't really know what I was missing, but, you know, then I would go to an Eastern Catholic parish that was nearby when I lived in a different town, and I go there somewhat regularly, and I was like, wow, this is awesome. And I'd feel a little let down when I went to the back to Novus Ordo, but my wife was like, I am Western, I'm a Roman Catholic, ain't no way. She loves the East, don't get me wrong, but she's like, this is my parish, has to be a Latin. And I was like, okay, you know you're the cradle Catholic, I'm the convert, I'll go along with that, that sounds fine to me. But eventually, when I started going to a traditional Latin mass, I saw the similarities with the Eastern more than I did with the Novus Ordo, because I was like, oh, wow, all, you know, a lot of the reverence, a lot of the focus and stuff like that, just a lot of little things about it, which I won't get into here. And that's kind of got me there, because, I mean, I want to say to anybody who's watching and listening, if you have the opportunity to go to an Eastern Catholic liturgy, you absolutely should. I mean, you should, if there's one in your area, you definitely should. And again, they're in communion with Rome, so there's no question of it being a, you know, you're doing anything wrong. It fulfills your mass obligation and things like that. I know the East doesn't have that, but the point is that it does fulfill your mass obligation, things like that. So,
yeah, I really encourage my friends to come. I say, hey, I'm not trying to make you a member of this parish, but come a couple times, because I think it'll make you really appreciate what you have in the West. I mean, honestly, seriously, even in Novus Ordo mass, I think it will help you appreciate it more. And you'll see, again, the authentic diversity. You'll see the different emphasis, but you'll see also the complementarity and how they're you know, so closely aligned in what they're trying to do, even if there's a different approach,
right,
and so forth. There's just a richness to me. There's such a richness to the text. You know, obviously there's different musical traditions in the different Eastern rites. I've experienced a lot of different ones. Like you have the choir situation where you're kind of more of a bystander observer at times. That's kind of a danger there. But in our parish, it's very much congregational singing. That's more of the Ukrainian approach, which I love, having come from a small fundamentalist church where we sang all the time. And I love that. So on a subjective level, that really appealed to me. And I think just the size of the parish for me too, for my wife and I, coming from small evangelical churches, on that, again, on that kind of subjective personal level, really resonated with us. And so there are definitely subjective aspects to it, right?
Right.
But it's been, again, a real blessing for us to have been part of it for all these years now.
That's awesome. Well, before we go, where can people, obviously, Catechetical Report, Ignatius Insight, but where can people find out about the stuff you're up to?
Yeah, Catholic World Report is really my main focus right now. And I'm just working on things there, and then working on some other projects for Ignatius Press, which will come to fruition. And I just had a little coming out, I think, in the next week or so, end of the month, a little book on Advent that's coming out from Catholic Truth Society. I did one for Lent for them last year, and this is coming out in about a week.
Okay.
And just a reflection on, again, on the Western reading. So, you know, somebody's going to sue me eventually for doing this. It really is. It's some stuff that
it's the same Bible.
It's from Scripture. It's really about scriptural reflections on Advent. And it draws a lot on the work of John Paul II, Benedict, a little bit of Pope Francis in there as well, who has done some nice things on Advent. And then Jean Danielou, his great book, Advent, which I really love. So that's coming out from Catholic Truth Society here pretty soon.
Okay, great. Well, I encourage everybody to check that out, especially read Catholic World Report regularly. I do, so I'd encourage everybody to do that. So, okay, I think we're going to wrap it up there. And thanks, everybody, for listening and watching. And thanks, Carl, for coming on the program.
Thank you.
Okay, everybody, until next time, God love you.